we were shaken violently out of bed. Our house shook real good.
Two large earthquakes and more than 100 aftershocks rocked southeast Alaska and the Yukon. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 1st. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, some Alaskans aren't happy with President Trump's reversal of Obama's offshore protections for the Bering Sea.
People are on the coast that we work with are a mixture of just outraged and disappointed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
May kicked off to a shaky start in parts of southeast Alaska. Two major earthquakes woke residents early this morning. They were some of the most powerful quakes Haines area residents have felt in years, but caused hardly any damage in Alaska. KHNS's Abby Collins reports.
The first quake struck around 4:30 a.m. According to the Alaska Earthquake Center, it had a magnitude of 6.2. The quake was centered in a remote area between the U.S.-British Columbia border and the Yukon. It was about 55 miles from Skagway and 60 from Haines. Jim Stanford lives about 26 miles up the Haines Highway.
We were shaken violently out of bed. Our house shook real good. Probably in over 30 years, that's the most violent shake we felt.
Stanford says the quake knocked pictures off the walls and glasses off shelves, but there wasn't any structural damage to his home. Adrian Revena lives about a mile from the border.
We've lived with earthquakes forever, 35 years worth. This was probably the most dramatic in regards to actually being able to feel it.
A little after 6 a.m., Revena felt the second quake, which was a little bigger than the first at an about 6.3 magnitude.
I mean, you could just really feel the whole ground. You could feel simultaneous movement in different places of the house.
According to the Earthquake Center, that one occurred around the same area as the first. The organization's state seismologist Michael West says while the quakes caught area residents off guard, they are not surprising. He says they occurred around the Denali Fault System, one of the most prominent in the state. Alaska is earthquake country, the most seismically active region in the U.S. No significant damage has been reported in Haines or Skagway, and the same goes for Juneau. But that wasn't the case in Whitehorse, the Yukon's largest city. According to the CBC, the city experienced power outages and buildings were damaged. CBC radio host Sandy Coleman was interviewing a seismologist live on the air when the second earthquake struck.
All the lights are shaking, and it's still going.
You might want to get under your desk if it's still shaking.
Okay. Do I take the microphone with me?
Sure thing.
I think it's still swaying a little bit. It's quite amazing.
More than 100 aftershocks were reported throughout the day Monday. Seismologist West says those are expected to continue in the days and maybe even weeks to come. But he says the intensity will taper off. West says the quakes occurred close to the Earth's surface.
So these earthquakes were essentially right along the Haines Highway corridor. They were very shallow in the earth, which makes the shaking much stronger.
West says it's fortunate they occurred in a remote spot. The location in the unpopulated area off the Haines Highway helped limit the damage caused by the quakes.
These are the same size earthquakes that, killed 250 people in Italy last summer, killed 150 people in New Zealand just a couple of years ago. So these are very, very vigorous earthquakes. We're fortunate that Whitehorse, Haines, some of our other nearby communities were actually at some distance from this earthquake.
According to responses on the U.S. Geological Survey's website, residents as far south as Petersburg reported feeling the earthquakes. In the event of a quake, experts recommend getting on the ground, finding cover from falling objects, and holding on. They use the catchphrase, drop, cover, and hold. The Alaska Tsunami Warning Center said there was no tsunami risk from the earthquakes. The Haines and Klondike highways remained open Monday, with no damage to the roads reported. In Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
A California-sized chunk of the Arctic will remain designated as critical polar bear habitat. That's the effect of a U.S. Supreme Court order today, declining to hear an appeal from the state of Alaska, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and an oil industry trade group. The area stretches from the Canadian border in the northeast, along the coast, and down to Hooper Bay in the west. It includes barrier islands, but 96% of the critical habitat is offshore. The polar bear was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 2008. Oil industry advocates say declaring such a large area as critical habitat adds uncertainty to development plans. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says the habitat designation doesn't require developers to obtain additional permits, though it may add a few pages to permit documents. President Trump signed an order last week lifting his predecessor's restrictions on offshore leasing in the Arctic. At the same time, Trump also revoked an Obama decree that created the Bering Sea Climate Resistance Area.
People are on the coast that we work with are a mixture of just outraged and disappointed.
Attorney Natalie Landreth represents the Bering Sea Elders Group. The elders are concerned increased ship traffic through the Bering Strait will damage their marine mammal hunts. They say Obama's protection of the Bering Strait was done at their request. For Landreth, the key part of Obama's order was that it created a tribal advisory committee.
That was the big victory in it, was the inclusion of local Alaskan voices in federal decisions, and they cannot figure out why that would be targeted to be taken away. They just don't understand it.
Trump's order cites the goal of streamlining regulations. Back in December, Alaska's congressional delegation issued a joint statement slamming Obama's Bering Sea directive as an attempt to lock up resources. Senator Dan Sullivan called it a unilateral action to hurt Alaskans. Today, Senator Lisa Murkowski's spokesperson said the senator thinks federal officials should still consult with Bering Sea elders and other locals when they make decisions for the area. According to a computer model developed by nonpartisan budget experts, the extra money from an income tax would help Alaska's state government withstand low oil prices or poor investment returns. But House members say there's only so much they can learn from the model. Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton says lawmakers must ultimately make a call about what is right for the state.
You can only help us so much because the rest is policy calls, whether we want to have cuts and job cuts.
The model found the budget would be balanced in 9 years if the state had an income tax and oil prices are lower than state officials expect. At those same oil prices, a Senate plan that doesn't include income taxes would lead to the state spending $500 million more than it raises in 9 years. North Pole Republican Tammy Wilson notes the model doesn't take into account the Senate majority's proposed future spending cuts. Wilson says the legislature has passed bills that could reduce spending. She says it's too soon to say cuts will fall on specific services.
There are bills that we all passed here that had to do with Medicaid, that had to do with the crime bill. There's some education reform that's going on by the new commissioner that we're supposed to see things. So I don't think we can say it's going to come from a specific area.
The House and Senate have passed different plans to draw money from permanent fund earnings and limit permanent fund dividends, but they haven't made any public progress on resolving their differences. David Teal directs the nonpartisan division of legislative finance. He pointed out one of the benefits of passing a permanent fund plan is the state would no longer be draining the constitutional budget reserve. Teal says this piggy bank could empty in the next 2 years, forcing the state to borrow money to pay its bills. Teal says some Alaskans want to see progress one way or another.
Some may say, I just want stable or growing reserves. Another way to say that is, I want a balanced budget. And I don't particularly care how we get there.
The House Finance Committee plans to compare the House and Senate plans throughout this week. The Senate Finance Committee canceled its meetings today and tomorrow. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after 75 years, Alaska recognizes the black soldiers who built the Alaska Highway.
Not my words, it's the federal government's words that this highway really was the road to civil rights.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Southeast Alaska's largest tribal organization has applied to the federal government to put 7 parcels in downtown Juneau into a federal trust. That would make the land tribally sovereign and could exempt it from some local laws. KTOO's Jacob Resnick explains.
For decades, the federal government had prevented Alaska Native tribes from putting their lands into trust. But a court decision last year overturned the so-called Alaska exemption, opening up new opportunities for tribal sovereignty that mirrors Indian country in the lower 48. The Juneau-based Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska is nearly at the end of this process. Its application calls for putting 7 downtown parcels into a federal trust. The land includes the Andrew Hope Building and surrounding parking on what was once a summer village inhabited by the Ok Tlingit.
We have really no plans to really get into any kind of big ventures there or anything. It's going to stay a parking lot. You know, in fact, we need more parking, not less. So, you know, we're not going to see us throw up a 5-story shopping center or something like that.
That's Richard Peterson, the Central Council's president. He said putting land into trust would be a milestone and make the tribe eligible for more federal grants. So far, only 1 other Alaska tribe has completed the process, and the issue remains controversial.
When land goes into trust under these circumstances, it removes regulatory authority over the parcels.
That's Juneau City Attorney Amy Mead. She says there are complex issues here. Tribal sovereignty can affect anything from local zoning to police and fire coverage.
And those issues need to be worked out before the city can take a position. We really don't know what Central Council's position is with respect to how we're going to coexist.
But Peterson says the tribe plans to work all that out with the city.
We want to have an agreement so that we have law enforcement. We certainly are worried about fire protection, so we want to talk to them about what that means.
The public comment period set by the Bureau of Indian Affairs is slated to expire May 5th. The city has asked for a 30-day extension. Mead says the law requires the Juneau Assembly to deliberate in an open meeting, and scheduling that takes time.
These are very new in Alaska, so we're doing the best we can, trying to find our way through this process.
Peterson says the city's appeal to slow down the process hasn't created acrimony.
You know, I understand their desire to want a little extra time to make sure they can take a look at things. You know, I don't think we have really any opposition to that.
A ruling by the Bureau of Indian Affairs over the city's request for more time is expected within the week. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
A 3-year-long legal argument about committing foster children to North Star Behavioral Health Hospital is one step closer to resolution. A judge ruled in late March that the Office of Children's Services can legally commit foster kids to the psychiatric hospital without getting a judge's approval. Anchorage Superior Court Judge Aaron Marston ruled that the state's civil commitment statutes don't apply to North Star because it is not included in the legal list of designated treatment and evaluation facilities. Assistant Attorney General Stephen Bookman, who argued the case on behalf of the state, says there isn't a specific statute that limits the amount of time a child can stay at North Star.
You have to remember that parents will take their children to North Star Hospital. And if you were attempting to arrange for medical care for your child who has experienced a psychiatric crisis, it might seem odd that there's a statute that says you can't do that, or that that has to be judicially reviewed.
In Judge Marston's order, he argues that OCS is the legal guardian of foster children, so they have the right to voluntarily send children to North Star if necessary. About 2 years ago, he mandated a judicial review of each case within 30 days of the child entering the institution, meaning a hearing had to be scheduled by a judge. OCS policy already requested judicial oversight. The tribes of Hooper Bay and Kuginak wanted a review within 72 hours, which is what the law says is required for adults who are involuntarily committed to a designated psychiatric treatment center. Bookman says 30 days seems like a reasonable amount of time for a review to ensure that foster children are receiving the medical care they deserve.
I think the right in having a judge review the admission to North Star has to be balanced against the need to make sure that the child's needs are being properly evaluated, and it is going to take some time to do that.
For the tribes, the 30-day review requirement was not what they were seeking, but it's still a small victory. However, the tribe's lawyer, Sidney Tarswell, says the ruling that civil commitment laws do not apply to treatment facilities that are not on a designated list has far-reaching implications.
That idea that any facility that's not a designated treatment facility or evaluation facility, that they're not governed by these laws, there's no reason that would be restricted to foster youth. That could be any person could end up locked in a psychiatric facility for as long as the facility wants, for whatever reason, without any court oversight.
Tarswell says some procedural matters still need to be settled before they can decide if they're going to appeal the case. An Anchorage firefighter is suing over what he says is a pattern of racial and age discrimination at the Anchorage Fire Department. The lawsuit has been brewing for the past 2 years, but a judge's recent decision against the municipality of Anchorage means it's headed to trial this summer. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove has more.
Jeff Graham is a Korean-American in his 50s, and he's worked for the Anchorage Fire Department for more than 20 years as a mechanic and a firefighter. But in his lawsuit, Graham alleges that hidden racism at the fire department is causing it to violate not only state law, but also the municipality's own rules regarding testing and promotion. Graham says he was passed over for promotion while younger, less qualified candidates moved up the ranks at the fire department.
And there's really white guys here, to put too fine a point on it.
That's Graham's lawyer, Jeff Jarvie, in a courtroom recording. Jarvie is arguing a specific point before a judge. But here's where it gets to the heart of what this case is all about.
Our public resources need to be allocated in some fair and objective manner and just not an old boys club of who you like best and who's most popular among the guys.
Jarvie's client, Graham, says in court papers he always received good performance reviews and was trying to get promoted to engineer. At one point, Graham says he passed the exam and was even working as an acting engineer. Graham says he was later informed that he was no longer eligible and found out that the fire department had changed the test and made it more subjective. Graham subsequently failed the test several times and claims it was unfair because the test was biased against him. He says in the court papers that he was asked in the peer review portion of one test about a false rumor that he had been buying TVs, renting them out, and then returning the TVs to the store to get his money back. Graham describes that rumor as false and racist. That is just one of Graham's complaints. But in regards to all of his claims in the lawsuit, the municipality of Anchorage denies any wrongdoing.
He would have to prove objectively that he was treated differently than other employees, and there's no evidence of that.
Assistant Municipal Attorney Monica Elkinton is a lawyer representing the municipality.
Everybody who is promoted to engineer has to pass the same test. They are asked the same questions. He opens the door to the questions that can be asked. So if he doesn't want to talk about whether he believes he has a reputation for honesty, then he doesn't have to talk about that. But that's the way the peer review works.
Elkinton was also arguing a specific point, which was only part of the municipality's effort to get the lawsuit dismissed. But the judge did not toss the suit, and now both sides are gearing up for a trial by jury this summer. So while the jury is yet to be picked, and there are still many more issues on which these lawyers remain at odds, there is one thing they can agree on. Both sides declined to comment for this story. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Casey Grove.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Pacific University Early Honors Program satisfies high school graduation requirements while students earn college credits from a regionally accredited institution. Apply at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Yesterday, Governor Walker signed Senate Bill 46 into law, establishing October 25th as African American Soldiers' Contribution to Building the Alaska Highway Day. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, the bill was signed in two different places. The first was at an Anchorage church.
Sunday's service at Shiloh Baptist Church in Anchorage was fairly typical, with the exception of some of the guests in attendance. Governor Bill Walker, his wife Donna, as well as Senator David Wilson and his wife Alita were sitting in the second row, as Pastor Alonzo Patterson spoke about how the Bible teaches that change will come to those who wait.
Waiting can be problematical sometimes. It's hard to wait till change comes.
It was a fitting message considering that Walker was at the church to sign legislation that advocates argued was 75 years overdue. Senate Bill 46 was introduced to commemorate the black soldiers with the Army Corps of Engineers, who, in 1942, came up to build the Alaska half of the Alaska Highway. Many of them came from southern states and had never seen snow before. The army was segregated at the time, and the white soldiers built the half of the highway that led through Canada. The army wouldn't be desegregated until 1948. However, many people believe that the building of the Alaska Highway was a major factor in desegregating the military.
Not my words, it's the federal government's words that this highway really was the road to civil rights. It took that question mark and turned it into an exclamation mark.
Governor Walker signed his first name at the church in front of community advocates who'd help raise awareness for the bill. His last name was later signed at the Veterans Memorial in the Delaney Park Strip of downtown Anchorage. At the celebration, Wasilla Republican Senator David Wilson, who, along with Anchorage Democrat Garen Tarr, helped the bill through the legislature, acknowledged the horrible conditions and racist attitudes the soldiers had to face. They often overworked and outbuilt their white counterparts, even though black soldiers were issued inferior tools and equipment.
This doesn't quite make it right, but it does acknowledge the hard work, doing something that's a nearly impossible feat, and I doubt it can be redone today. And it was that first road to civil rights that helped desegregate the Army and later the U.S.
Gene Pollard is a teacher and one of the main organizers of the Alaska Highway Project, whose main goal was educating people of the historical significance of the highway. She first learned about it in a PBS program.
Leah Morgan was telling the story 6 years ago, and I never had heard that side of the story before. I heard that soldiers built the highway. That's all I knew. But when she began to talk about black soldiers here, white soldiers there, I didn't know that at all.
Pollard contacted Morgan, and they and other advocates began to work with the Anchorage School District to get the story into Alaska Studies curriculums across the state. The group is also getting a memorial erected in Centennial Park for people to visit and learn about the story while looking at historical photos of the black and white soldiers. Shayla Dobson and her husband Jim will be in charge of creating it.
It will have on one of the granite panels the iconic photograph. And it will also have other photographs that people can then see what's going on. It will be a place where people can go if they don't know about the history. If they didn't get to take Alaska History's class, the information will be there.
During her remarks, Pollard made reference to the 2016 film Hidden Figures, a movie about black women who worked for NASA and were mostly unknown to history. She said the building of the highway was, quote, Alaska's hidden figures. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Fort Greely and Delta Junction officials are planning a day-long celebration on June 3rd to mark the 75th anniversary of the construction of the Alaska Highway and Allen Army Airfield. It will also emphasize the role of African-American soldiers who helped build the highway. Fort Greely will release more details in the coming weeks. The ice on the Tanana River moved to Nanana today, toppling and pushing the Nana Ice Classic tripod enough to trip the clock in the annual Ice Out guessing game. The official stop time was 12 noon Alaska Standard Time. That's an hour behind the current daylight savings time. Ice Classic organizers say they're still loading tickets into their database and will contact the winner or winners who guessed the correct date and time once they have finished checking the entries for accuracy. This year's jackpot is $267,444. Rhymes and Rhythms. That's the title of a new book of poems written by Angoon elder Frank Sharp. The book is scheduled for release later this summer. KCAW's Emily Russell visited the poet at his home in Angoon.
The first time I meet Frank Sharp, he's shoveling gravel into a wheelbarrow.
Frank! I didn't see anybody.
Sorry, I scared you. Frank is 85 years old. He's a small guy, but he's not frail. Underneath his navy coveralls, it looks like he could still run a 5-minute mile.
Believe it or not, I could have been in the Olympics.
I'm here to get his life story, Olympic bid and all. But when I ask him for his life story, he recites one of his poems instead.
I've been a soldier, sailor, kill my fellow man. Sought peace or religion, drugs, every way you can. I felt the eagerness of youth and the frustration of the middle years. I've laughed a million laughs and shed a million tears.
Frank has written hundreds of poems like this one. He stores them in an old cigar box. They're beautiful, even better when read by the poet himself. But Frank's life, it was far from perfect. We head inside to his kitchen, which overlooks the ocean.
You want coffee or anything? We've got some banana bread.
With hot coffee in our hands, Frank tells me about his childhood in Angoon and Tenneke Springs. He tells me about his father's taste for whiskey and women.
Now, my dad was a womanizer. I probably have 12, 13 brothers and sisters. I know of several already.
He tells me about his mother's many marriages. He even tells me how popular he was with German women when he was stationed there with the Air Force after World War II.
So that's part of the story, you know. You said, tell my life, I'm telling you the truth.
Somewhere in between all that, Frank lived in Kansas City, where he got wrapped up in the wrong crowd.
I became a gangster there. My name was Val Udo.
And if that wasn't enough risk for one lifetime, Frank has nearly died three times. The first when his boat sank in the Gulf of Alaska, the second when he had a massive heart attack, and the third just a couple years ago when he was out hunting deer in the winter at age 81. On the third day, he followed the sound of an Alaska Airlines flight west out of the woods.
It's been quite a life. I could go on for hours because I told you, I've had so many adventures, it's unbelievable.
And a lot of those adventures, they're the subjects of the poems being bound into the book called A Pioneer Alaskan's Lifetime of Rhymes and Rhythms. The book will be published by the Island Institute with links to audio, so you can actually hear Frank recite his own poetry.
Got a lot to do yet, but I know my time's running out. My frosting's wearing thin. I'm fighting a war I'll never win.
But he keeps fighting, fixing up his home, maintaining the miles of walking trails on his property. I get the sense Frank Sharp has a hard time sitting still.
I'm still pushing the wheelbarrows up from the beach, though it's killing me to do it.
Yeah, what? Why do you do it?
Because it's there.
After a while, though, it's clear there's more to the story, like the part about his wife, Alice.
Pardon?
What about your wife? What about Alice?
Oh. Now you really get me. See, I'm already watered up.
Alice died in 2000, and the thought of her quickly brings him to tears.
I'll get it here in a minute. Why didn't I tell her then what I can't tell her now?
He'd tell her he loved her, that she was beautiful. That's Frank's biggest regret, so he tries to make up for that through his poetry and this property. He wants to be remembered for those things. He even moved a boulder to make that happen.
It weighs about 400 pounds, and I brought it up and put it there because it was the only gold-looking rock on the beach.
And on that gold-looking rock, there'll be a gold-colored plaque. It'll be placed right in front of his house with a poem on it.
The Lord gave this man vision, strength, and time to work this land.
It says his legacy lives on in this land. It lives on in people's hearts, too.
Through his poems and stories, he led us on many a journey of laughter, fear, love, and tears.
In rhymes and rhythms, Frank Sharp lived. Reporting in Angoon, I'm Emily Russell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. With reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Abby Collins in Haines, Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Emily Russell in Sitka, and Casey Grove and Wesley Early in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Sean Dugan's our editor and producer, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, helping create jobs for Alaskans for more than 40 years. 78% of the BP employees who work here live in Alaska. Information at bp.com/Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.